This week, we're going to spend an hour on something that sounds, at first, like a small administrative story, universities turning off their AYA detectors. Turnitin's detection feature disabled. Faculty told to stop pasting suspect essays into tools that were never validated for the job. Before we get into it, here's what keeps nagging at me. The detectors didn't get worse this year. They were exactly as unreliable in 2023, when institutions were leaning on them hardest, as they are now, when institutions are quietly walking away. So the thing that changed wasn't the machine. The thing that changed was our willingness to act on a number we never had the right to trust. And that means the real story isn't about a tool failing. It's about how long an institution will keep punishing people on evidence it secretly knew was junk, and what finally makes it stop. You're listening to Tertulia, the AI conversation, slowed down. This week, the collapse of AI detection as enforcement. Universities are switching off the machines that were supposed to catch students using AI to write their essays. Not because they've stopped caring about cheating, but because the detectors turned out to accuse the innocent, resist any appeal, and rest on no validated benchmark at all. We want to sit with what that collapse actually means, whether it's a retreat from technology or a rediscovery of something much older. And whether the classroom is really the frontier, everyone treats it as, or the last room to learn a lesson that got taught, expensively, somewhere else first. Let's go to the table. Let me start by saying who's in the room, and I want to do it by what each of you has actually been chewing on lately, rather than by the line on your business card. To my left, someone who's been rereading the history of automated adjudication, the welfare systems, the fraud detection machines, and keeps insisting the classroom story is a footnote to a much older one.
That's a fair characterization, and I'll only slightly resist the word footnote. I think it's a reprise, but yes. I've spent the last month back inside the literature on automated decision systems in the public sector, and every time I read a news item about a professor turning off Turnitin's detector, I feel like I've read the ending before I got to the middle.
Across from him, someone who reads across disciplines and is comfortable saying when she hasn't sorted something out yet, which, honestly, is why I wanted her here for a topic this tangled.
Happy to be the person who doesn't know. And I'll tell you up front, I came into this week thinking the detection collapse was obviously good news, and I've gotten less sure of that as I've read. Not because detection was good, because I'm not certain what replaces it, and I don't love the shape of the thing I see coming.
We'll pull on that. Next, someone who works inside actual institutions in the global south, ministries, public universities, the places where a policy written in one country becomes a mandate in another with none of the same resources.
Thank you, and I want to plant a flag early, because I think this conversation is going to be very North American and very well resourced, unless somebody stops it. When a university in the United States turns off its detector, it has the option of replacing that with more human attention, smaller sections, more teaching assistants, oral examinations. In many of the institutions I work with, the detector was the human attention. It was standing in for staff who don't exist. So, just turn it off. Lands very differently, depending on where you're standing.
That's exactly the pressure I want in the room. And finally, the person who won't let any of us get away with a claim we can't back up.
I'll try to earn that. And I'll begin by being skeptical of our own premise. We keep saying detection is collapsing, is it? Or is a handful of well-publicized universities making a change that generates a lot of coverage precisely because it's contrarian, while the vast, quiet majority keeps the detector switched on and keeps failing students on it? I don't actually know the denominator here, and I'd like us to be honest that we don't.
Good. So let me lay out the phenomenon as cleanly as I can, and then we react. The written edition this week, the longer view column, which I think we've all read, puts it like this. For about 3 years, academic integrity offices had a machine that could take a student's paragraph and hand back a percentage, an AI detection score. And that score got treated the way a breathalyzer reading gets treated, as the kind of evidence that ends an argument. The column's claim is that the machine is being switched off. Not because A, cheating stopped, because the number was never evidence. It was, in the column's phrase, a verdict dressed as a measurement.
And that phrase is doing a lot of work because the whole scandal is in the costume. The measurement was real, in the trivial sense. The detector really did compute a number. What was fraudulent was the dress. Somebody put a robe on it and sat it behind a bench.
Right, and I want to be precise about what the number actually measures, because I think even people who use these tools daily are fuzzy on it. An eye writing detector doesn't detect eye. It detects a statistical property of text. Call it smoothness or low perplexity. Prose that's too evenly distributed, too much in the fact middle of what a language model tends to produce. That's it. It's measuring how much a paragraph resembles the average output of a machine, which means the thing it flags most reliably isn't cheating. It's a certain kind of careful, unadorned, rule-following writing.
And whose writing is that?
That's the question, isn't it?
It is the writing of a student who learned English as a second or third language and was taught to write it correctly and plainly. It is the writing of a student who was drilled in a five-paragraph structure because that structure was safe. In my region, the students most likely to write the clean, formulaic, too smooth prose that these detectors flag are very often the students who worked hardest to write correctly at all. The detector doesn't flag the sloppy native speaker who takes risks. It flags the anxious second language student who colors inside the lines.
So the false positive isn't random. It has a demographic.
The false positive has an accent.
And this is where I want to insist we widen the lens, because the column does something I think is exactly right. It refuses to treat this as a classroom story. The false positive, with a demographic, is not new. We built an automated system in Michigan. This is a matter of public record. It's documented at length to detect unemployment insurance fraud. It was designed, and I want to quote this because the wording matters, to treat almost any data discrepancies or inconsistencies in an individual's record as potential evidence of illegal conduct. But ow.
40,000.
More than 40,000 residents of a single state accused of fraud by a machine that mistook a discrepancy for a confession. And the reason I lead with that number is that it was on the public record years before anyone pasted a student essay into a detector. The classroom didn't discover this failure. The classroom reran it.
Can I sit on that word, reran, for a second? Because I think it's the most important word we've said so far. If Michigan had been an accident, a one-off bug, then the classroom repeating it would be a coincidence. But it wasn't a bug. The column's argument, and I think it's correct, is that this is a structure property of the method. You take an infinitely complex human situation, you boil it down to a handful of machine-readable features, the proxies, and you throw away everything you couldn't measure. And then you treat the proxy as if it were the truth, a discrepancy in a benefits record, a smoothness score in a paragraph, same move, same failure.
So the argument on the table, and I want to test it, not just accept it, is that these are not four separate stories. Welfare fraud, predictive policing, biometric identification, and the classroom. They're one story with one recurring failure, played in four rooms.
And that's a beautiful thesis, which is exactly why I distrust it. Beautiful theses flatten differences. Let me name one. In the Michigan case, the harm was a clawback, money seized, sometimes lives destroyed, people driven to bankruptcy. That's catastrophic. A student getting a transcript notation is bad. It's unjust, but it is not the same order of harm. When we say same failure, we risk borrowing moral weight from the welfare case to inflate the classroom case. I want the classroom case to stand on its own harms, which are real, without leaning on the welfare disaster for gravity.
I'd accept that as a friendly amendment. The column actually preempts you. It says the difference between a benefits clawback and a transcript notation is a difference of scale and not of kind. I think you're pressing on whether scale can become kind. whether a large enough difference in magnitude is, functionally, a difference in nature.
I am pressing on exactly that, and I don't think it resolves cleanly.
Let's hold that, because I think it's going to come back. But I want to get the why this week on the table, because that's what makes it a topic and not just a theme. What actually happened, in the last stretch, that made institutions start switching these off?
The lawsuits, for one, or the fear of them. A student accused on a detector score, who can prove, with draft history, with version logs, that they wrote the thing themselves, and who then asks the institution, on what evidence did you accuse me? And the institution has to answer, a proprietary number from a vendor, whose method is a trade secret that we cannot explain and you cannot examine. That answer does not survive contact with a due process complaint. It doesn't survive contact with a parent who is a lawyer.
And the vendors themselves started backing away, which I find telling. When the company that sells you the detector starts publishing language like, this should not be used as the sole basis for an accusation, that's the sound of a legal department getting nervous. They put the number in your hand, and then, quietly, they put a disclaimer under it that says, don't actually rely on this for the one thing you bought it for.
Which is a remarkable product, when you think about it. Sold for enforcement, disclaimed against enforcement.
Say more about why that's remarkable, because I think a listener might hear, well, every tool has a disclaimer.
Because the disclaimer isn't covering an edge case. It's covering the core use. Imagine a breathalyzer sold to police departments with fine print saying, readings from this device should not be used as the basis for a charge. You would say, then what? Precisely, am I buying? The disclaimer doesn't hedge the product. It negates it. And the fact that institutions bought it anyway and used it anyway for years, that's the part I actually want to understand. Not the tool, the buyer.
The buyer was under pressure. Let's be generous for a moment. A wave of generative writing tools arrives. Faculty panic. Administrators need to be seen to respond. And into that panic walks a vendor with a dashboard and a number. The number is a form of relief. It converts an unbearable ambiguity. Is this student cheating, and how would I ever know, into a clean percentage? It's that they were desperate for a way to not have to make the judgment themselves.
So the detector was, in part, an anxiety management device.
It was moral outsourcing. You didn't have to accuse a student. The machine accused them. You just enforced.
And that's the thing. I keep coming back to that. Unsettles me about the collapse is good news story. Turning off the detector doesn't turn off the anxiety. The thing that made faculty grab the number in the first place, the genuine, unresolved question of what it means to teach writing when a machine can produce competent writing on demand. That's still sitting there. If we celebrate the detector's death without answering that, we've just taken away the sedative and left the patient awake.
And in my institutions, we can't afford the therapy that's supposed to replace the sedative. That's what I keep pressing. The North American answer to turn off the detector is return to human judgment, more oral exams, more process writing, smaller classes. Every one of those costs staff time. A public university with 60 students in a writing section and two overworked instructors did not adopt the detector because it was seduced by a dashboard. It adopted the detector because the detector was free labor. Take it away and you have not solved anything. You have returned the unpaid work to people who are already drowning.
That's the tension I most want to keep alive through the hour. The gap between the diagnosis, which I think most of the table shares, and the remedy, which is not equally available to everyone who has to apply it. Let me zoom out for a second before we go into the longer arc. Is everyone at least agreed on the diagnosis that the detector, as an instrument of enforcement, never had the thing enforcement requires?
I'll agree to that with one reservation, which I'll keep in my pocket for later. I'm not yet convinced that raise a suspicion for a human to examine is meaningfully safer than carry a verdict, because I've watched how a suspicion, Once a machine raises it, colors every human judgment that follows, but diagnosis of the enforcement claim, yes, agreed.
Agreed, and eager to trace how we got here.
Agreed on the diagnosis, uneasy about the cure. That's my whole position, and I'll defend it all hour.
Agreed, and asking who pays for the cure.
Then let's go back in time. And I want to do the thing this show is actually for, which is to look at the arc, not this week's headlines, but what the serious writing has been saying about automated detection over the last couple of years, and where our own publication has landed on it before, because the column makes a striking claim about that arc. It says the rhetoric swung wildly and the reality never swung at all. Walk me into that.
Let me set the timeline, because it's genuinely surprising when you lay it out. Go back to the winter of 2024. The loudest voices on automated detection were sounding alarms, and not about classrooms, about policing, when the American Civil Liberties Union put out its white paper that December on AI-generated police reports. The coverage treated the technology as a hazard first and a tool second. The framing was defensive. Detection was something happening to people, something to be contained. That was the register at the end of 2024.
And then, over the first quarter of 2025, it flips. The alarm doesn't get answered. It gets outvoted. Detection gets reframed as rescue. You see it in the human trafficking coverage, where pattern recognition suddenly becomes a humanitarian instrument, a way to promote timelier interventions. You see it in cybersecurity, where detection is narrated as pure upside. The bias problem, which had been the whole basis of the December skepticism, doesn't disappear. It gets demoted. It becomes a to-do item.
And this is the part I find almost funny, in a bleak way. There's a piece from that period, a legal industry article, proposing a 10-step bias elimination audit. A checklist, as though discrimination in an automated system were a configuration error you could resolve in 10 legible steps. Step 1 through step 10, and the bias is gone.
The checklist, standing in for a cure.
The checklist as a genre, actually, because a checklist promises that the problem is bounded, that it has a finite number of parts, and you can tick them off. The whole appeal is the implication that there is a bottom to the well. And the argument the column makes, the argument I've come around to, is that there is no bottom. The bias isn't a set of 10 settings. It's a property of the method. You cannot audit your way out of the thing the method is doing.
Because the method is proxy substitution. And a proxy is biased in exactly the direction of whatever it left out. You can't audit that away because the bias isn't in the tuning. It's in the decision to use a proxy at all.
So the grammar of the writing shifts. What was the tell?
The column names it precisely, and I think it's the sharpest observation in the piece. The tell was grammatical. The more confident the writing became, the more it treated the machine's output as evidence rather than as suggestion. That's the whole slide in one sentence. There's a document from that period whose title literally screams the opposite. Something about inhuman reason and predictive policing and the Fourth Amendment, and in the Trade Journal Register of the moment, even that got coded as a neutral examination of a maturing tool, not an indictment, a progress report. The question quietly changed from, should the machine accuse, to, how do we tune the machine's accusations?
And I want to note what happens to a piece like that when it crosses a border. A document, written as a careful legal caution in one country, arrives in a ministry in another, as evidence that the technology is mature, is being adopted, is inevitable. The caveats don't travel. The momentum travels. By the middle of 2025, you have surveillance coverage describing automated systems as rapidly expanding across the globe, with the regulators cast as the ones running late. Expansion presented as weather. Oversight presented as the thing that overslept.
Expansion presented as weather. I want to steal that. Because weather is the perfect alibi. Weather isn't anybody's decision. If adoption is weather, Then no vendor sold it. No administrator chose it. No procurement officer signed for it. It just arrived like a cold front. And that framing does an enormous amount of moral laundering.
This is where I want to bring in our own prior work, because we've written adjacent to this before. There was a piece in the iLiteracy series, early 2025, that noticed something specific about how the literature talked about these tools. Do you want to name the delta?
I'll name it. That earlier piece, ours, pointed out that the literature kept framing a tools as instruments for enhancing critical thinking. The software and the scrutiny were said to point the same direction. And what's striking, reading it against the detection story, is that in the enforcement literature, they point in opposite directions. The detector isn't there to enhance the instructor's scrutiny. It's there to replace it. The scrutiny is the cost the tool promises to remove. So the delta is, our earlier framing, worried that A might erode critical thinking by doing the thinking for us. The detection story is that same erosion, but institutional. The institution's judgment atrophies because the machine judges for it.
That's the connection I'd have missed. It's not just students outsourcing their thinking to a machine. It's the disciplinary apparatus outsourcing its judgment to one. And the second is arguably more dangerous, because the student outsourcing their essay only hurts their own learning. The institution outsourcing its judgment hurts the accused.
Now, the column's central move is that while the rhetoric was doing all this swinging, the record sat still because the definitive failure was already documented before the optimistic turn ever started. And I want a genuine disagreement here, because I don't think the table sees this the same way. Is it fair to say the record sat still?
No, and this is where I want to push back on the column itself, respectfully, because I think it's too clean. The column says the reality never swung at all, because the failure mode was documented before the confidence arrived. But documentation is not reality. The Michigan case was documented, yes. It was also, for years, ignored, litigated, partially reversed, and then largely forgotten by exactly the people who went on to build the next system. So I'd say the reality did move. It just moved in a circle. It wasn't a still point. It was a repetition that each new domain experienced as a first time. That's different from sitting still. Sitting still implies a stable truth that everyone could see. This was more like an amnesia that kept regenerating.
I don't think we actually disagree as much as you're staging it. When the column says the record sat still, I read it as the underlying failure mechanism didn't change. The proxy problem in 2021 is the proxy problem in 2025. That's the still point. You're describing the sociology, how the knowledge failed to transmit, which is a different axis. The mechanism was stable. The memory was not.
But those aren't separable, and that's my whole point. If the mechanism is stable but the memory keeps failing, then the interesting problem isn't the mechanism. We understand the mechanism. The interesting problem is the amnesia. Why does each domain get to discover this as though it were new? And the column, by emphasizing the still record, underweights the amnesia, which I think is the actual engine of harm.
Can I offer a reason for the amnesia? I genuinely think it's professional identity. The welfare office people and the classroom people don't read each other. A professor in a writing program does not consider the Michigan unemployment system to be part of her field. So when the detector shows up, there's no channel by which the welfare lesson reaches her. Each profession has its own literature, its own conferences, its own sense of what counts as relevant precedent. The failure is fully documented. In a room, the next victim never enters.
This is exactly right, and I'll make it more concrete. In my country, the people running the university's academic integrity process and the people who fought the biometric identification rollout in the same city are not in contact. They may not know each other exists. The identification case had a full human rights literature attached to it, real analysis of what it costs when the machine gets a person wrong, and none of it was available to the integrity office, because the integrity office understood itself to be dealing with plagiarism, not with human rights. The knowledge was in the building. It could not cross the hallway.
So we have a real disagreement to leave unresolved. Whether the right frame is the record sat still or the record kept getting erased. I don't think we need to force that. Let me ask the harder version, though. Is there anything the amnesia frame explains that the still record frame doesn't, that changes what you'd actually do?
Yes, and this is why it matters and isn't just semantics. If the problem is a stable, knowable mechanism, then the fix is education. Teach people the mechanism, and they'll stop. But if the problem is amnesia, structural, professional, regenerating, then education doesn't fix it, because the knowledge already exists and still doesn't travel. What you need isn't more knowledge, it's a channel, an institutional memory that crosses the hallways. And we don't have that. We have nobody whose job is to carry the lesson from the welfare office to the classroom.
I'll concede that's a real distinction with a real consequence, and I'll adjust. I came in thinking the story was, we knew and ignored it. I think you've moved me to, we knew, in one room, and had no way to tell the other rooms. That's a sadder story and a more actionable one.
Let me bring in one more thread from the arc, because I think it's the load-bearing one. The column argues that beneath the bend tool and the opacity, there was a fact that should have stopped the whole enterprise before it started, that the tools were deployed without any proof they worked, no standardized benchmark. Say what that actually means.
It means there was no agreed, external, validated measure of how accurate these detectors were. The industry, this is documented in the big annual index of the field, has a persistent lack of standardized responsible A benchmark reporting. So when a vendor tells you the detector is 98% accurate, that number isn't measured against a shared public adversarial test set the way a medical diagnostic would be. It's the vendor's own number, on the vendor's own data, by the vendor's own definition of accuracy. It's a marketing figure wearing a lab coat.
Then accuracy on what distribution? A detector might be 98% accurate on essays written before generative tools existed, and near useless on the essays it actually faces now. Accuracy is meaningless without the population it was measured on, and that population was almost never disclosed. So even the 98, if you granted it, tells you nothing about the case in front of you.
And I want to connect this to the fragility problem, because they compound. Even if you had a benchmark, these systems are adversarially fragile in ways their operators don't anticipate. There's a lovely observation in the literature that even humans can be fooled by a certain crude style of adversarial attack. Put up a fake stop sign, paint a fake tunnel on a rock wall. But machine learning systems can be fooled by attacks a human would never even register, and that maps onto the detector with brutal precision. A determined cheater runs their generated text through a paraphraser and sails through undetected. Meanwhile, the honest second language student, writing carefully, gets flagged. The machine catches the honest and misses the guilty, which is the exact inversion of what enforcement is for.
And the students learned this faster than the institutions did. This is the part that I find almost unbearable. Within weeks of any detector being deployed, the students who wanted to cheat knew how to defeat it. The paraphraser, the humanizer tool, the run-it-through, a second model trick. The only students who couldn't defeat it were the ones who weren't cheating, because they had no generated text to launder. So the tool sorted the student body into cheaters who evade it and honest students who are exposed to it. It functioned as a filter that specifically caught innocence.
That's a devastating way to put it, and I want to make sure I understand the claim, because it's strong. You're saying the detector didn't just fail to catch cheaters. You're saying it structurally selected against the honest.
The cheater has an incentive and a method to escape the detector. The honest student has neither the incentive nor the awareness. So over time, the population the detector flags becomes enriched for the honest. The longer you run it, the worse its accusations get. Not because the machine degrades, but because the guilty adapt and the innocent don't. It is a filter that gets more unjust the longer you leave it on.
That's a genuinely new formulation to me, and I think it's important. The standard critique is that the false positive rate is unacceptably high. Your critique is dynamic, that the false positive rate is not fixed, it climbs, because the base rate of guilt among the flagged shifts as the guilty learn to evade. That's a more damning claim, and I don't think the column quite reaches it.
So we've extended the piece there. Good. Before we move into the pushback, let me make sure we've named the third failure the column identifies, because it's the one that turns a bad tool into a crisis rather than just an embarrassment.
Opacity, and it's the one I'd underline three times. The problem isn't only that the machine errs, every instrument errs. The problem is that you cannot cross-examine a model. When the evidence against you is a probability generated by a proprietary system, whose workings are a trade secret, the accusation cannot be tested, and an accusation that cannot be tested is not evidence. That's not a high-minded principle, it's almost a definition. Evidence is the kind of claim you can confront. A trade secret number is precisely the kind you can't. The ECLU's objection to the police report tools was never mainly that they erred. It was that a defendant cannot cross-examine a model. Same objection, different room.
And notice the vendor's interest here is aligned against the accused twice over. The vendor keeps the method secret to protect its business, which is legitimate as commerce and catastrophic as evidence. The very thing that makes it a viable product, its proprietary secrecy, is the thing that makes it inadmissible as proof. You cannot have both. Either it's open enough to challenge, in which case it's cheap to copy, or it's secret enough to sell, in which case it can't be confronted. The business model and due process are in direct contradiction.
Let's carry that contradiction into the next act, because I think it's where the argument gets genuinely hard, and where I suspect some of us are going to change our minds. This is the part of the show where somebody stakes out what they think this is actually about, and then we go at it. I'll invite whoever's ready to plant the flag.
I'll plant one, and I'll plant it hard, because I've been the one saying, diagnosis yes, cure uncertain, all hour, and I want to make the strong version of my discomfort. Here it is. I think turning off the detector, celebrated as a due process victory, is actually going to make the accusations more unjust, not less. And here's my reasoning. When the detector was on, at least there was a number, a thing on the record, a thing you could, in principle, contest, a thing that forced the accusation into the open. Turn it off, and the suspicion doesn't disappear. It goes underground. The professor still reads the too smooth essay, still gets the gut feeling, this was written by a machine, but now there's no number, no dashboard, no paper trail. Just a human judgment, which is even more biased and even less appealable. We haven't removed the bias. We've removed the audit trail on the bias.
That's a serious argument, and I don't want to wave it off. But I think it inverts the actual danger. The number wasn't a check on the professor's bias. The number was the thing that laundered it into legitimacy. Before the detector, a professor's hunch was just a hunch. Nervous, contestable. Something the professor knew they'd have to justify. The detector took that hunch and gave it a percentage. It converted an unstable prejudice into a hard figure that ended the argument. So the number didn't audit the bias, it armored it.
Wait, hold on. I want to actually think about this rather than pick a side, because I feel myself being pulled both ways and I don't like it. The skeptic's point is, without the number, the bias is invisible and unappealable. The academic's point is, with the number, the bias is legitimized and unappealable. And those might both be true. The number might be simultaneously an armor for the bias and the only visible handle on it, which would mean turning it off is genuinely ambiguous. You lose the armor, but you also lose the handle.
Thank you. That's the ambiguity I've been trying to name all hour, and it's why I won't sign the collapse is unambiguously good card.
Let me press you both, because I think the ambiguity resolves if we ask a specific question. When a professor accused a student on a detector score, could the student actually contest the number? In practice?
No, not in my institutions. And I think this is where the skeptic's argument, which is elegant, breaks against the ground. The number was never contestable in practice, because contesting it required the student to understand a proprietary statistical method, hire an expert, and argue against an institution that treated the number as final, precisely because it was a number. The theoretical appealability of the score was never real. What was real was, the machine said 90%, the committee deferred to the machine, the student had nothing to argue against except, trust me, the I wrote it, so we are not losing a functioning appeals mechanism by turning it off. We are losing the appearance of one.
But then, what stops the professor's naked hunch from being even worse?
Process. And this is the thing I want to insist on. The alternative to the detector is not the professor's naked hunch carries the day. The alternative, the good alternative, is a process where a machine can never be the accuser at all, where a suspicion from any source, human or machine, triggers a conversation, not a verdict. Where the student is asked to talk through their draft, walk through their sources, show their thinking, in my institutions. When we replace the detector with a 5-minute conversation, tell me how you arrived at this argument. All the actual cheaters revealed themselves, and the honest students were vindicated in a way no number ever allowed. The conversation is more accurate than the machine, and it's confrontable by definition, because it is a confrontation.
Okay, that moves me, because that's a genuine third thing. It's not detector on versus invisible professor hunch. It's a process where no automated output is ever allowed to be the accusation, where the machine at most prompts a human to start a conversation. And in that framing, the skeptic's worry is answered because the professor's hunch also can't be the verdict. Neither the machine nor the hunch accuses. The process does.
I'll partly walk back then. I came in saying turning off the detector makes things worse. I think I was wrong about the comparison I was making. I was comparing detector with a contestable number to professor with a secret hunch, but the first term of that comparison was fictional. The number was never contestable. So the real comparison is detector hunch, laundered as a number, versus human hunch, which at least has to become a conversation to have any force. And the second is better, I'll grant that. There, what I won't grant yet is that institutions will actually build the conversation. My fear is they turn off the detector and build nothing, and you're left with the naked hunch after all.
That's a fair and important residue, and it's the Leyden practitioner's original worry come back around. Turn it off and build nothing. Let me widen this, though, because I want the ethicist's version of the objection, even though we don't have an ethicist at the table, so I'll put it to the academic. Is there a case that the whole conversation instead of detection model just relocates the bias into the professor's face-to-face judgment, where it can operate on accent, on race, on class, with even less accountability than a number?
There is that case, and I won't pretend it away. A 5-minute conversation is not bias-free. A professor primed to distrust a certain student will hear hesitation as guilt. But here's the distinction I'd hold on to. A conversation is embedded in a relationship and a record that other humans can review. If a pattern emerges, this instructor keeps accusing second language students after these conversations. That pattern is legible, it's institutional, it can be challenged by a colleague or a dean. The detector's bias was invisible by design, buried in a proprietary model no one could inspect. So I'm not claiming the human process is unbiased. I'm claiming its bias is inspectable. And inspectable bias is the only kind you can ever fix.
That's the same move you made in the last act, inspectable versus buried. And I notice it's becoming the load-bearing distinction of the whole episode. Not machine bad, human good, but buried bias versus inspectable bias. The detector's sin isn't that it was biased. Oof, 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 Oof. Everything's biased. Its sin is that it made its bias unreachable.
I want to introduce a complication that I think genuinely threatens the neat version of our story. What about the vendor's new pitch, that the answer isn't detection at all, it's process capture? Keystroke logging, draft history surveillance, tools that record every edit a student makes so the institution can prove the writing was human. Is that the future the detection collapse is actually clearing the way for?
This terrifies me more than the detector did, and I want to be very clear about why. The detector was an accusation you could at least fight after the fact. Process capture is total surveillance before the fact. It says, we will watch every keystroke you type, from the first word, so that we can prove you human. That is a far deeper intrusion. It turns the act of writing an essay into a monitored performance under a camera, and it will be sold as the humane alternative to detection. We're not accusing you, we're just recording you. The gentleness of the pitch is the danger.
This is the pattern the whole arc predicts, isn't it? Detection, as verdict collapses and the industry doesn't retreat, it migrates. It offers a new product that solves the due process problem by making the surveillance so complete that there's nothing left to appeal. You can't dispute the keystroke log. It's the same move as the police body camera that was sold as accountability and became a surveillance instrument pointed at the public.
And notice it fails the same test if you actually press it. A keystroke log proves a human typed the words. It does not prove the human composed the thoughts. A student can read a machine-generated essay off a second screen and retype it, keystroke by human keystroke, and the log will certify it as authentic. So process capture is another proxy, typing as a proxy for thinking, and it will fail for the identical structural reason. It measures the feature it can see and discards the one that matters.
That's the amnesia again. We're about to rerun the exact same failure. Proxy mistaken for proof, one domain over, with a new product, and everyone will experience it as new. We could write the postmortem now. Keystroke logging, 2028. Universities disable draft surveillance amid due process and privacy concerns after it emerged the logs certified students who retyped machine text and flagged students who compose in their heads and type fast.
Let me do the callback I've been holding. Earlier, the Leyden practitioner said the false positive has an accent. I want to ask whether process capture has a class, who gets surveilled.
The class question is exact. Process capture requires a certain kind of device, a certain kind of connection, a certain kind of software environment. The student writing on a shared computer in a lab, or on a borrowed phone, or offline, and then typing it up, that student cannot produce the clean draft history the system wants. So they'll be flagged not for cheating, but for poverty, for not writing in the monitored, continuous, single-session way the tool expects. The affluent student, who writes on their own laptop with the plug-in installed, produces a beautiful, exonerating log. The poor student who wrote it longhand on the bus and typed it up in one sitting looks to the machine, exactly like someone pasting in generated text. Same essay, different infrastructure, different verdict.
And that's precisely the Michigan structure again. The machine treats a discrepancy, here, an unusual writing process, as evidence of wrongdoing. It cannot distinguish wrote it on the bus from pasted it from a bot, because both produce the same anomalous log. The anomaly becomes the accusation. We have learned nothing. We have just bought a more expensive way to not learn it.
So let me try to force a reframe, because I don't want us to end Act 3 in pure despair. If process capture is just detection's sequel, and the real lesson is no automated output can be the accusation, is there anything the machine can honestly do here?
Yes, and I think the honest job is smaller and more useful than anyone wanted. The machine can raise a question. It can flag a paper and say to a human, look at this one more carefully. That's it. Not this student cheated. Just this one's worth a human's attention. The whole catastrophe was in the grammar. We let a suggestion masquerade as a verdict. Push the machine back down to suggestion and it's fine. It's a research assistant, not a judge.
And here's my residual worry, which I'll voice and then let the table sit with, because I genuinely haven't resolved it. Once a machine raises a suspicion, can a human ever truly treat it as merely a question? Or does the flag itself contaminate the conversation that follows? If the professor walks into the "tell me about your draft" conversation already told by the machine that this essay is suspect, the professor is no longer neutral. The suspicion has been planted. So even the modest job, flag for a human, might not be as innocent as it sounds, because the flag changes the human.
That's the anchoring effect, and it's real. I don't have a clean answer. The only mitigation I can imagine is that the human never sees the flag before the conversation, that the flag routes the paper into a review process without telling the reviewer why it was routed, blind the human to the machine's reason, which is possible in principle and almost never done in practice, because the whole appeal of the flag was that it told you what to think.
I love that as a design principle, and I have no faith any vendor will build it, because a flag that won't tell you its reason is a much harder product to sell than a dashboard that hands you a percentage. The unsellable thing is the honest thing. That's been the whole story.
On that, the unsellable thing being the honest thing, let me pull us toward the close. Same question to each of you, about a minute each. And I want the honest version, not the recap. Not, here's what we covered. What actually changed in your thinking this week. Ideally, something you didn't expect to say when you sat down. Let's start where we usually don't. Layton practitioner.
What changed for me is that I came in angry at the detector, and I'm leaving angrier at what's replacing it. I expected to spend this hour defending the students who'd been falsely accused, and I still do. But somewhere in the middle, I realized the fight I've actually been having in my institutions isn't over yet. It just changed uniforms. We won the argument against the detector, and the same vendors walked back in the same week, selling us surveillance of the writing process itself, dressed up as the gentle, humane, non-accusatory alternative. And I almost fell for the gentleness. That's the thing I didn't expect to admit. The gentleness of the new pitch nearly got past me. So what changed is that I've stopped watching for the accusation and started watching for the surveillance, because the harm moved and I need to move with it. And I keep thinking about the student who wrote their essay longhand on the bus. Nothing we build should ever make that student look guilty. That's my line now. It wasn't this specific before this hour.
Skeptic.
I walked back a claim tonight, which I try to do out loud so it counts. I came in convinced that turning off the detector would make things worse, that the number, whatever its faults, was at least a visible thing you could fight, and removing it would drive the bias underground into the professor's unaccountable hunch. I still think that's a real risk, but I was comparing the real world to a fiction. The contestable number was never contestable in practice. Nobody could actually fight it, so I was defending an appeals mechanism that didn't exist. What changed is that the honest comparison isn't number versus hunch, it's hunch laundered as a number, which ends the argument, versus hunch that has to become a conversation to have any force. And the conversation, for all its flaws, is the better of the two, because at least it can be wrong out loud where someone can hear it. What I still don't know, and I'll say it plainly, because I'm supposed to be the confident one, is whether institutions will actually build the conversation or whether they'll just turn off the machine and leave the hunch standing there naked. I don't know. I genuinely don't. And that uncertainty is the honest end of my week.
Senior academic.
I came in with a tidy thesis that we knew about this failure and ignored it. The Michigan case sitting on the record the whole time, a story of institutional bad faith. And I got talked out of the bad faith. Not out of the failure. The failure is real. The 40,000 were real. But out of the idea that anyone chose to ignore it. What I was moved to, and I'll credit the person who moved me, is that the knowledge existed in one room and had no way to reach the next. The welfare office lesson could not cross the hallway to the classroom because the two professions don't read each other, don't share a literature, don't recognize each other's disasters as their own. That's a sadder story than bad faith. and a more useful one because it tells you the missing thing isn't knowledge, it's a channel. We have no institution whose job is to carry the lesson from one domain to the next. And I think, honestly, that's a job this kind of conversation is quietly trying to do and mostly failing at and should do better. That's what changed. I stopped being angry at the amnesia and started wanting to build the memory.
Newest thinking.
I came in thinking the detector's collapse was good news, full stop, and I'm leaving without the full stop. What changed is that I found the distinction I'll be using for a long time, and it isn't the one I expected. I expected the lesson to be, machines shouldn't judge humans. But that's too easy, and it's not quite right, because humans judging humans is also a disaster half the time. The real distinction that emerged tonight is buried bias versus inspectable bias. The detector's actual sin was never that it was biased. Everything's biased, or professor's biased, I'm biased. Its sin was that it made its bias unreachable, proprietary, secret, final, and that reframes what we should demand of every one of these systems, including the surveillance ones coming next. Not be unbiased, which is impossible, but be inspectable, which is a design choice somebody keeps declining to make. And the thing I didn't expect to say, the honest version of every one of these tools is the version nobody can sell, because a machine that raises a question without answering it, that shows its reasoning, that refuses to hand you a verdict, that's a worse product and a better instrument. The whole disaster was that we kept buying the sellable thing. I don't know how you fix a market that's structured to reward the dishonest version. That's the piece I'm leaving without.
I'll take the last 30 seconds for myself, which I rarely do. What changed for me is the breathalyzer, actually, the image I opened with. I reached for it as a metaphor for false certainty, and by the end I realized it's the wrong image, and the wrongness is the whole point. A breathalyzer, for all its flaws, is validated against a public standard, calibrated, challengeable in court, and it measures the thing it claims to measure, alcohol, directly. The detector was a breathalyzer that measured your accent and called it your blood, and we let it end arguments anyway, for 3 confident years, because the number felt like the science we wished we had. What changed is that I no longer think the story is about a tool that failed. It's about a hunger, an institutional hunger, to not have to make a human judgment about another human being, and to hand that judgment to a machine so that no person has to own it. The detector didn't create that hunger, it fed it. And the surveillance tools coming next will feed it too, until we admit the thing the whole hour circled. A machine can raise a suspicion. It cannot carry a verdict. And every institution that forgot the difference has been quietly, expensively, walking it back, at the cost of students who deserved better than a number. Thank you all. This was the good kind of disagreement. Tertulia is the weekly conversation from iNews Social, designed and edited by Dr. Diego Bonilla, with a cast of voices produced through Chatterbox on a single workstation. Next week, we return to the table. For now, thank you for spending the hour